No species in nature grows indefinitely. And when they do, they get slammed back if they attempt to do so. Humans will be slammed back. As long as we keep striving for solutions from within the same set of beliefs, values, assumptions, and behaviors that created the problem, cannot solve the problem. I mean, the human system is simply vastly larger at its current level of consumption and pollution than the Earth can manage. It's as simple as that. We're fuck-ups.
Dr. Rees, we have all these threats facing humanity. Climate change, AI taking people's jobs, with the Iran-Israel conflict, nuclear proliferation is back on the menu. But what do you see as the greatest threat facing us?
Well, I think if you think of all of those things that you've listed, they have one thing in common, and that it's human beings. Quite frankly, we are the greatest threat to ourselves. Almost everything we are doing is a product of a Paleolithic brain trying to cope with the complexities of a modern world that are far beyond the capacities of human understanding. Look at the controversies over AI, for example. It's a human invention. It's capable, I don't think it's capable of thinking better than humans, but it can calculate thousands of times better. It does that many, many more transformations. But we haven't a clue where it's taking us, what it's doing, whether it's going to be good, bad. Some people fear it's going to be the elimination of the human race. But it's like so many other technologies that start out with all kinds of promise and then lead us into a bit of a mire. So everything you've listed and many more we can talk about are the result of human activities that have really got out of control, that are beyond the capacity of the human animal, which is still a primitive beast. Actually, our brains have degraded considerably in the last several tens of millennia, and we're just not capable of coping any longer in the world that we've created.
What do you mean by that? How have our brains degraded?
Well, it looks as if, for example, the human brain maxed out in size a couple of 100,000 years ago. Now, size isn't everything, even in brain terms, but it's certainly indicative of something going on. And I think there's enough studies also to show that ever since the invention of the printing press, what we've done essentially through technology is offloaded a human mental exercise onto machinery or gadgets of one kind or another. And the brain is just like a muscle. If you don't lose it, use it, you'll lose it. And so we see a decline in human intelligence, in IQ, very modest but measurable, even with the advent of things like the cell phone and the computer. So basically, these things have become external prosthetics. They're devices by which we've offloaded activities that used to be mental activities onto the external world, and hence we just don't exercise our brains as much as we could or should. I think this is becoming increasingly well established, and it's an increasing worry for many people in the neuropsychology business.
Yeah, I'm sure you miss the prospect of working in a university system with the advent of like ChatGPT and having to read papers and term assignments that are coughed up by some sort of algorithm.
Certainly excellent examples. I mean, I haven't had any much experience with it. Back in the day, we had ways of checking some papers to see whether bits and pieces were plagiarized, lifted out of something in the literature. But now, I mean, students apparently are writing in well, they're not writing at all. They ask a few questions, and the machines do the thinking for them, the research, put the paper together. So we may be graduating idiots. Young people have not done a lot of work. I'm serious. This is not something we should be laughing at, because, again, it's just one of those things that have gone beyond our control. Here's the basic line. Humans evolved. We're just like any other species. But humans are a very long-lived creature, and we have very low reproductive rates relative to many other organisms. So it takes generations and generations, thousands of years for evolution and major evolutionary changes to take place, noticeable ones. If a Cro-Magnon walked into your office fully dressed as a modern human, you wouldn't know the difference. And yet that individual is like 50,000 years earlier. Meanwhile, technology has proceeded at breakneck speed, beginning with agriculture 10,000 years ago, and of course with the industrial and scientific revolutions 300 or 400 years ago. So things have vastly outpaced human evolution. Technological evolution or cultural change has vastly outpaced human evolution.
Hey everybody, hope you're enjoying this episode. If you want to support this channel, just please remember to like and subscribe.
And of course, drop us a comment. Let us know what you think is the greatest problem facing humanity.
So we've gone from a situation where humans lived in very simple environments, meeting very few people. You might meet, what, a dozen people in your home tribe or whatever, and 100 other folks in the course of your lifetime. You wandered around in a limited home range. Nothing changed in the course of your lifetime that was of much significance. Today, we live in cities of millions. We're not adapted to live in cities of millions. We live in environments where there are so many overlapping complex systems, none of which we fully understand. Who understands the global economy, really? Who gets the internet?
Trump.
Well, Trump. Of course. Yes. Well, perfect example of someone who's deluded with their simplistic brain into thinking they understand something that's so vastly more complex than they are.
This podcast is going to be used in like a deportation trial.
Okay, so I'm barred forever from entering the United States. But that's already happened. So what I'm getting at is that we're just beyond our depth. We're floundering. We're a piece of flotsam going along with the tidal jet, and we're not really in control of the situation. Well, we never were in control, but now we don't even understand. And worse, we don't understand that we're not in control.
Right. But I mean, I guess the trade-off is that now we have things that keep us alive longer, that, you know, resolve healthcare issues, not systemic, but like health issues, right? We have penicillin. We have evolved into more complex systems, but it has improved the overall quality of life for the average human. Is that not true?
Not necessarily.
Go on.
Well, look, I'd probably be dead a dozen times now if it weren't for some of those miracles.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, we have to take a long view again. If you go back to the pre-agricultural period and examine the bones and teeth and so on of some of our hunter-gatherer ancestors, it's quite clear that they had no disease. We have pandemics today that were unheard of prior to the advent of complex, concentrated, high population cities. Most of our diseases are transmitted from animals to humans as a result of the domestication of animals and the kind of environments that we've subsequently created. You know, look, a city is a perfect breeding ground for every kind of disease you can imagine. And again, primitives were not plagued by those kinds of diseases at all. Their teeth, we're outstandingly good, no dental caries. So dental care is something that is an advent of civilization as a result of starchy and sugar foods that have only been around for the last few thousand years. So yeah, there's very good advances, you could say, in health. But on the other hand, the average quality of life of a person who actually lived isn't necessarily all that better.
Yeah, actually, we had a professor on from the University of Calgary, and he had lived with hunter-gatherers for over a decade. Every summer, he would travel to Southeast Asia and live with a group. And, you know, he noticed, and this is backed by research as well, with other modern hunter-gatherer tribes, but they were happier than people in the West. And, I mean, that's just a staggering fact that the techno-optimists, I've yet to see anyone grapple with that. Like, why is that the case? Like, surely all this advancement should make us not just live longer and survive, you know, broken bones and all these things, but it should, you know, you would hope, like, make us a bit happier. But yeah, so
the pursuit of happiness is really another modern creation in many respects. I don't think any other civilization has been so preoccupied with it. But you raise a really important point. And again, we know from longitudinal studies for decades now that happiness has been in decline in wealthy industrial countries, at least since the post-war period. If I'm not mistaken, North America peaked in happiness, people's sense of well-being and optimism about the future and so on, in the 50s and 60s. So as our incomes have doubled since then, and more so, our degree of happiness, felt well-being, has been in steady decline. So there's an
things like the threat of thermonuclear war constantly lingering over everybody else that I'm sure put a damper on things.
That gets back to something we started talking about, the sheer complexity of life. Right. Little brains can handle.
But even if we grant that, like, individually we might be better off in certain respects, like health, and even if we just, again, grant that we're happier than we were before, there have been massive trade-offs in other domains, and this is where, you know, you're an expert in ecological overshoot. Maybe talk to the audience, especially people that may not be as familiar with your work. What have we fucked up? just give us kind of like a brief summary of all those things.
Okay, I'm going to do that, but I want to go back to one thing. We keep talking about we. Who are the we we're talking about? There's still a billion people on this planet who can't feed themselves adequately and who live in shit conditions. There's no one group of humans. So we're really talking from a very privileged Western, relatively wealthy position. So where have we screwed up? Overshoot is a concept that ecologists have talked about for decades, but probably the best place for someone to start in terms of the human condition is a little book called Overshoot by William Catton, I think in 1984. At any rate, the argument here is, and something I've embellished to some degree, overshoot is a state in which the consumption of even self-renewing resources exceeds the rate at which they can regenerate, and the rate at which human beings create waste products, mostly toxic or often toxic at any rate, exceeds the rate at which natural systems can assimilate and recycle waste products. So we're in it. And by the way, if you think about that for about 30 seconds, you realize that overshoot is a terminal condition. You cannot keep undermining the biophysical basis of your own existence indefinitely.
And you've listed out in your work in the past various symptoms of overshoot as it's reflected in society. Sure. Could you just briefly describe some of those? Like, well, point to
climate change. Climate change is the most obvious symptom. This is a very complex story around climate change, because you could make the argument that we're using climate change, or at least some elements of our society are using climate change, as a distraction from the real problem, which is overshoot. So people are, as I said, we have very simple brains. We tend to think in simple one-on-one relationships. We think of the immediate cause-effect relationships. We don't get the big picture. We don't connect the dots. So if you can distract everyone into thinking that climate change is the existential threat, where's the environmental movement fallen in the last decade? It's completely forgotten because everybody is now focused on this imminent threat, climate change. But that's like focusing on a headache when you've got a brain tumor. Take all the aspirins you like. It can relieve the pain temporarily, but you haven't solved the problem. So overshoot is a Mac, what I call a meta system, or a meta problem rather. It's the overriding cause of climate change, ocean acidification, fisheries collapses, species extinctions, the enormously falling rate of biodiversity loss, or increasing rate of biodiversity loss.
Deforestation.
Absolutely. So all of these things are symptomatic of the same general cause. If you look at any one of them, they're either the result of overconsumption, the excess use of materials and energy extracted from the ecosphere by human activities, or they're the result of waste deposits. Climate change is a waste management issue. Most people aren't aware, but carbon dioxide, that, you know, visible gas, odorless gas, is actually the single largest waste product by weight from industrial economies. It's a perfectly natural substance. It's absolutely essential for life on Earth if we don't. But You know, too much of a good thing is too much of a good thing. You can drown in water, which is absolutely essential for life. Well, so what we're doing is, again, this is a long story. If you go back a few million years, several tens of millions of years, there was a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But the sun wasn't nearly so bright. So over the last billion years or so, as the sun has got brighter, the world process, the living systems of the planet, have evolved in such ways as to extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and deposit it in the ground in the form of calcareous rocks, limestone, marble, and so on, as well as fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, all once in the atmosphere, now underground. But the point is, it lowered the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide, which kept the Earth from overheating. So that even though the sun has gotten something like a third brighter or a quarter brighter in the last couple of billion years, the temperature has fluctuated within a few degrees of some tolerable point for life as we know it. This is the Gaia hypothesis, that life is self-regulating. Life as we know it created the environment as we know it. The atmosphere would contain zero oxygen without the photosynthetic processes. Similarly, the nitrogen in the atmosphere and oceans would be in a completely different distribution. It's the way it is because of living processes. Well, we're going around screwing up those processes. And one of those ways is by taking the carbon dioxide that the living systems have deposited in the Earth and returning it to the atmosphere. So we're triggering a global warming process as a result of our excess waste disposal using the atmosphere as a waste dump for our industrial activities. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are other side effects. There's no such thing as a side effect. They're all just effects. Ocean acidification as a result of carbon dioxide dissolving in ocean waters is now disrupting marine life. And so on down the line, we could carry on this indefinitely. But again, all of this underscores the incredible complexity of living, dynamic, complex systems, far beyond the capacity of human beings to connect these dots before they happen. In other words, we know most of what I've just said by hindsight, not because of any clever investigative techniques. We're floundering.
The problem is getting so complex to attach to the point we started with over small brains, smooth brains, but the problem is getting so complex that human cognitive function can no longer keep up with it. We are no longer in a place where we can adequately process the compounding issues coming out of overshoot.
I think that's an excellent summary of what I've tried to say for the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, you talked about just general complexity, but I think people need to understand, you know, the issue is each of these, like topsoil depletion to ocean acidification to global warming, these are all like nonlinear kind of dynamics that are at play.
Yeah.
And if you had an infinitely powerful supercomputer, you still, if you try to model these things, you still might not arrive at the actual answer because,
I was just going to say,
from a mathematical standpoint, these are actually almost, in some ways, almost intractable problems.
Well, I don't know whether you could even say in some ways they are, in a sense, very untractable problem. Listen, all of our models are based on what we know. And by definition, they can't be based on what we don't know. Right? By definition, they cannot be based on what we don't know. So we create a model. It's necessarily, look, all models are intended to be simplistic or at least simple descriptions of complex systems. And what we learn from models is how much we don't know about the real world. For example, in the last couple of years, climate scientists have come to realize that they don't know what's going on. So climate science is probably one of the most advanced areas of Earth physics, if you will, with some of the most advanced models running on some of the fastest computers on the planet. And yet climate scientists now admit they don't really know what's going on. There are so many things left out of the models that the models aren't capable of capturing the nature of reality. And in many respects, that a kind of a parallelism to what we've talked about the human brain. The human brain is a marvelously complex system, but relative to the nature of the issues we're dealing with, it's simple. Humans tend to think in simple terms, mechanical terms, in simple cause-effect relationships. The real world doesn't look like that at all. One of you mentioned the fact that complex systems are not linear. We think in linear terms. So a common, if you talk to people about global warming, for example, the common assumption is, well, if it gets too warm, we'll back off and things will be better. But that's not how it really works. We may cross some temporal or point of temperature at which the system flips into an entirely different domain of stability. That's what a tipping point is all about. So complex systems do not behave in a predictable linear manner. They may do so for a period of time, and then they hit a certain threshold, some variable within that system hits a threshold, and it flips the entire system into a different domain. So supposing we cross into a system where we get runaway climate change, which raises the temperature fairly rapidly by, say, 10 degrees, it could stabilize at that point. Now we have a stable environment. Like I said, there's no life on Earth as we know it, because that 10-degree temperature is far beyond the capacity of at least complex life as we know it to sustain itself.
Hey, guys, if you're enjoying this episode, just another quick reminder to like and subscribe.
Dr. Reese is talking a lot about the existential threats facing humanity. If you have any thoughts on solutions, what we could be doing to resolve some of these things, we'd love to hear about it in the comment section.
There was a study just a year or two ago to show that it even at current rates of warming, if we think of it even in linear terms, about a sixth of humanity to a third of humanity will be outside of our customary, what you might call a climate niche, the range of climatic condition in which human beings evolved to survive. So we're already at the point where we are rendering virtually uninhabitable or threatened to render uninhabitable large parts of the Earth in which hundreds of millions or billions of people live. So if this continues for long, even linearly, we have a huge problem. And the concern is it's likely to be nonlinear. We may get some major jumps forward if the Thwaites Glacier breaks off and we wind up with a 3 or 4 meter sea level rise in a matter of a few years. That's it. That's unbelievable catastrophe.
Yeah.
Most of our world's coastal city, tipping point.
Yeah, and not to mention all the geopolitical impacts from, you know, mass migrations and all that. Like, I mean, that's just, yeah, it's unfathomable what would happen. But
I don't pass on that point, because you've raised an extremely important issue. For a decade or so, maybe more now, both the United States and Europe have been concerned about the trickle of migrants from South America.
It's destabilized European society to a certain extent. The debates around it have completely unhinged European politics to a certain extent.
But what we're seeing is a mere trickle. Yeah. And if we wind up with one of these catastrophic tipping points, that will become a flood, and it becomes unmanageable utterly. And geopolitical disorders, the order of the day.
You've talked a lot about this idea of an ecological footprint, and you've kind of built this method of analysis and everything. And you've come to the assessment that the Earth can sustainably, i.e. not depleting renewable resources, can sustainably house about, what, 2 billion people?
2 billion, yeah.
So, roughly that number?
Well, very, very, very roughly. In fact, I could communicate quite regularly with colleagues who think the number is less than 100 million. So there's, and look, you can find economists and others who think it's a trillion. So the range of estimates of the human population are orders of magnitude apart.
But the fact of the matter is that we're at about 8.2 billion.
That's right.
Right
and,
now.
And
there's a bit of an overshoot there that we have to account for.
Absolutely. But most people, you see, we don't, our culture doesn't recognize that. What we're trying to do blindly is to do everything possible to get that population safely to 10 billion or more before we think seriously about the overshoot problem. So take your pick. Let's get really serious. Overshoot means right now the Earth is not sustaining 8 billion people. In fact, it could probably a quarter of the people on Earth are using up most of the carrying capacity of the planet at present. And by the way, we're doing that, assuming the inputs of all sorts of techno fixes, such as fertilizers and pesticides, which increase the productive output of the landscape. It's destroying the soil and all of that, but at least we're maintaining the flow of foodstuff. So we're inflating the productivity of the land even to sustain current population. So if you look at, let's go to the eco footprint. The ecological footprint is a measure I came up with a few years ago. By the way, lots of work by excellent students. I just came up with the idea. They've developed it and gone on to take it to the world. But the point I'm getting at here is that it's a simple concept. Everybody should realize that the first question of human ecology is how much of the Earth's surface is necessary in continuous production and assimilation to sustain just me in the lifestyle to which I've come accustomed. That's the eco-footprint concept. So if you were to take your annual shopping basket, everything you eat, everything you consume, all the wood, paper, blah, 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 and so on, all the fossil fuel you use and so on and so forth, and trace all of that using material flows analysis back to the land and the atmosphere and so on, you could have a pretty good idea of the exchanges required between yourself and the rest of the ecosphere just to maintain you. And what we've done with eco-footprint analysis is to convert all of those material and energy flows into the land area needed to produce the food and fiber and to assimilate the wastes in a sustainable manner. So if you're a typical North American, it would take about 15 acres or more, 18 acres. That's a lot of landscape for one person, especially when you consider that, by the way, I'm going to think in hectares more than acres because we do our calculations. The international way.
The northern neighbor.
Very un-American, I understand that. But the point I'm getting at then, on Earth today, anybody can do this. Go to your library, look up all the geology texts and geography texts and so on. And look, add up all the forest land, all the grassland, all the agricultural land on planet, and you won't come up with anything bigger than 12 or 13 billion hectares. Multiply that by 2.47 to get acres, so 25, 30 million acres, something like that, billion. Okay. Look, there's 8 billion people on Earth. So if you divide the 12 billion hectares of productive land by the 8 billion people, you're entitled, by the way, I put that in air quotes, to 1.5 hectares per person. So what's that, about 4 acres?
And I did crunch some numbers, and I want to bring this kind of abstract concept to reality for people. So a hectare is about 1.5 soccer fields. You can think of it as that size
for most people.
So you said the sustainable amount of hectares per person is about 1.5. So well, you can think of like, yeah, so a couple of soccer fields basically per person. Now, the global average utilization is at, I think, 2.8 hectares per person. And the U.S., as you just said, the U.S., based on U.S. or North American standard of living, is about 8. So if you do this math and you apply it to, say, New York City, so if you go by what's sustainable, New York City would actually have to be the size of Greece to support all the people.
Right? Yeah.
But if you go by the U.S. standard of living, so if they were to kind of maintain more or less their standard of living in New York City, and they probably use even more. I mean, I don't know. But you're looking at slightly bigger than the size of France or slightly smaller than the size of Texas. So this is like just to bring this home, I think. To reality, like that is what we're grappling with. That is the overshoot. That is the disconnect that we have.
Yeah. So again, this goes back to the way we think simplistically. You can read in any number of geology texts or geography texts how urbanization occupies only 1 to 2% of the Earth's land surface. So there's lots of room. I've been with economists in aircraft looking down at the ground, and they look at me and say, how can you say the Earth's overpopulated? Look at that. It's empty. There's nobody down there because of these vast expanses of land where there's no urban settlement. But what you described with New York is what I call the urban ecological footprint. And, you know, we've done dozens of cities around the world just to show that the eco-footprints of cities, what we think of as urban land, is actually several hundred times larger than the geographic area of those cities on the landscape. So Tokyo is a city of some 30, almost 40 million people, a million people, the population of Canada, by the way, in one city. But it has an eco-footprint of about 4 hectares. So if you multiply that by the productive area of if you multiply that by the population and compare it to the productive area of Japan, Japan couldn't support its capital city on its domestic biocapacity, the productive land and waterscapes of Japan. So like many other countries on Earth, Japan is very, very much dependent on trade flows to maintain itself. I have argued that globalization is the single largest force right now destroying the planet, because what it does is enable places like Japan and most of Europe, for example, to vastly exceed their domestic carrying capacities by importing goods from elsewhere. But of course, by doing so, they're depleting elsewhere, depriving other peoples of going to their full potential, although that's probably a good thing. And in the meantime, people in those importing countries are blind to the fact that they are, in fact, dependent on somebody else's ecosystems.
You've used the quote, neoliberal economics, is in fact.
Exactly. So here we have again, you're getting into one of my pet peeves, but neoliberal economics is what we call a social construct. It's a made-up fantasy. I call it otherworldly economics because it has literally nothing to do with planet Earth. It starts from the assumption of human exceptionalism, that we're not part of nature and that the economy and the ecosphere are entirely separate systems. So it can't even monitor what we've just been talking about. Economists talk about money flows. They don't look at material and energy flows. So a country like Holland is said to be self-sufficient in agriculture. In fact, it's an exporter, but that's only in money terms. If you look at the actual agricultural footprint of Holland, they import fodder from a vastly larger area than the country to grow the animals and chickens and whatnot that they then use to produce high-value products for export. So import cheap fodder, export expensive processed high-protein foods, and you can have a positive trade balance in money terms, but you're completely an ecological deficit in ecological terms, in terms of the energy and material flows. So what neoliberal economics does is give us an entirely distorted perspective on human realities. Economists talk now about dematerialization, about decoupling, because you know, they've externalized everything. That's not working. We do get real pollution problems. So they said that, well, we can decouple from that. So they monitor the amount, say, of emissions per unit growth in GDP, and they show that the emissions aren't rising as fast as the increase in GDP, so therefore we must be using less and less fossil fuel and other resources per unit growth. And therefore, if this trend continues, the economy can decouple from nature. But that's absolute bloody nonsense. If you look at the reality again, human beings are now, we've gone from much less than 1% of mammalian biomass 10,000 years ago, at the dawn of agriculture, to the point where humans now constitute 33 or 4% of the sheer weight of mammals on the planet. And if we had our domestic livestock, the animals that we use to sustain ourselves, humans plus domestic livestock are something like 97% of the weight of mammals on Earth. So that the natural wildlife have been displaced 3%. Again, it just shows that the complete, what I call competitive displacement of other animal species, mammal species, from their ecosystems by human demands. So here we have a fantasy in our minds that we're decoupling from nature, when in fact we have merged with nature to the extent that we've essentially displaced most other advanced species. Meanwhile, of all the other vertebrates on Earth, the thousands of species that are being monitored, their populations have fallen by 70% in just the last 70 years or so. So we've got a huge disconnect between reality and our way of thinking about things. Another example, the mass of human artifacts on the planet now exceeds the biomass on the planet. So the weight of stuff humans make is heavier than all the living material on Earth. Another one, humans now move something like 10 times as much material around the planet in mining and construction and all of those kinds of heavy duty activities than all of the erosive forces of nature combined. So again, think of the magnitude of this disconnect, where we go around thinking we're decoupling, we're not really part of nature, when in fact we have become the majority component of every single ecosystem on Earth. And the largest force changing is the geological nature and the biophysical nature of the planet. You can't get more completely deranged than that. And it, now, of course, is one of the factors destroying us. We're fuck-ups, to put it mildly.
Well, we're fucking up also our fertility. Because, you know, we're releasing all these novel chemicals into the environment and we don't really understand the effects. And of course, that is also the interaction of novel chemicals within the human system from a health standpoint. It's another complex interaction that we don't actually understand. Talk to us about, you know, kind of fertility and the impact that may have on the population and ecological overshoot and so on, like how those dynamics play.
And then I suppose you would possibly call this a good thing that fertility rates are going down because we still have to make up for that like 6 billion excess of people that we have.
Yeah, we have to do that. Look, there's so much in these questions. Again, this is something we don't really know what's going on. And the systems are just so complex, we do not really know what's going on. So we talk about the falling sperm counts. It's not just humans, by the way. It's mammalian sperm counts. Because something we're doing out there is upsetting the basic physiology of reproduction, biochemistry of reproduction. It may be hormone mimicry. Many of our plastics and other industrial chemicals, plus the vast amount of female hormones being released in the environment and birth control pills and so on and so forth, is leading to the, in effect, the feminization of males of many different species. One impact is some say by now that the human sperm count is followed by 50 or 60%. And on its current trajectory, it may well be that the majority of human males will be sterile by the end of the century. I don't think that's a good thing. I think it's indicative of a complete disconnect again between our understanding of what's going on in reality, and I don't think rendering the human species extinct is necessarily a great thing. It might be good for the rest of the world, but it won't just be humans. As I say, these effects are occurring across the board in many other animal or mammal species. So we don't really know what's going on. It's a chemical, probably, hormonal, probably, but nobody's put a real finger on the exact cause. And by the way, we've known about this for a couple of decades. So it's not as if it's a new discovery out of the blue. But it's like so many things that come at us, and then in hindsight, we're trying to figure out what went wrong. I think the classic example goes way back to the 60s with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. She was the one who alarmed everyone to the effects of DDT on the environment. And one of those impacts was the collapse of predatory bird populations in the United States, in North America. The bald eagle virtually went extinct in the lower 48 states. And what we have found in hindsight, again, is that a breakdown product of DDT in the food chain was effectively acting as a hormone that blocked the formation of the calcium carbonate eggshells in rapturous birds. So the toxic contaminant builds up in the food chain, is a little bit in the vegetable matter, which gets eaten by insects, which get eaten by small birds, bigger birds, and mammals, and then all the way to the top of the food chain. By the time it gets there, it starts to have this hormonal effect, inhibiting the production of eggshells. So that female raptors, eagles, hawks, and so on, were laying eggs either without shells, with such thin shells, it was called the thin shell syndrome, that when they tried to roll the eggs over to keep them oxygenated in the nest, the shell would break, and that was the end of it. So virtual extinction. But again, it wasn't clever foresight that brought us to this. It was the fact that there was a mechanism we didn't even know existed that was messed up by the release of a chemical we didn't even know existed into the environment. Well, we knew about the DDT, but not the effects of the vape breakdown products. And this is happening over and over and over again. There are unintended consequences. Some call them side effects, but again, they are just effects, not side effects, unintended consequences of human technological innovation that have catastrophic events over the longer run, either for humans or for other species. And
okay, so
the decline in human sperm counts is just another example.
Well, so we want to make sure we're not stuck in the echo chamber. So in what ways could you be wrong? In what ways could advancement in technology, you know, could have positive unintended consequences that you can't see, where we can actually solve some of these issues?
Look, I find it very difficult to move into that territory. I don't think we're any better at looking at the so-called advantageous unintended consequences than we are at predicting the unintended consequences that are negative. So I just don't see it. I cannot understand how anybody at this point in our evolution, both cultural and biological, can see a bright light at the end of this tunnel. For example, I'm going to go off of a slight tangent here. We talked about 8 billion people on the way to 10. That's what the UN says at any rate. It may not get there because of falling sperm counts, among other things. Although, I think we will get there because of the huge numbers of young women of reproductive age right now. And the fact that pronatalism has made a great resurgence recently. People are panicking because of the thought of falling human populations.
Well, they're panicking, but they're not really offering any sort of like sustainable solution.
But the Russians, for example, have banned. You can now be thrown in jail in Russia for even talking about the benefits of childless living. And so
right, but simultaneously they're also sending the same children off to get meat grinded by a FPV drone. Like, yeah, that's not exactly conducive towards
I think the main concerns come from an economic standpoint of like, how are we going to support these older populations and just growth, right? Because growth is God. So how do we continue to grow if the population is declining?
And I agree with your point pronatalism is on the resurgence, but it's on the resurgence from some sort of mythical Christian interpretation of it versus like a cold, hard conversation.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's having a major effect. I'm just saying that it's gathering. It's gathering its feet under it.
And a meme does. Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so let's get back to the point I was trying to get at. This 8 billion people is a product of the last 200 years. Literally. It took, 350,000 years of human evolutionary history, 1 billion people in about 1810. Well, that was a couple of hundred years ago. Since then, we've gone up by a factor of 7 or 8. So it's an extremely recent phenomenon, this explosion of human numbers and all of our artifacts, all the stuff we've talked about in the past, is an extremely recent phenomenon. And it's the product of fossil fuel. Without fossil fuel, it simply would not have been possible. Fossil fuel isn't just fossil fuel. It's the means by which we acquire everything else necessary to produce all of our human artifacts and all of our human bodies. All the food and all the rest of it is a product of fossil fuel. Much more energy is expended in the production of our food than we get out of it, and it's all fossil energy. I don't think, and nobody I think is able to contradict this yet, that there's any substitutes for fossil fuel, and we're not going to be using them forever for two reasons. If we keep using fossil fuels, assuming we can keep finding economically viable supplies, then we're going to suffer climate catastrophe. If you stop using fossil fuels, then that's right.
And you've been a pretty outspoken critic of green energy revolutions, green technologies.
Yeah. Because I think it's a distraction for two reasons. First of all, it's not happening. For all that we've heard about the great transition, the energy transition from fossil fuel to wind and solar, last year, wind and solar provided 3% of consumer energy, final consumption of energy on the planet. Yet in some countries, it's up to 30% of electricity production. But globally, it's only 15%. And electricity is only 20% of global energy. So again, you're down to 3% of the world's energy supply. So there's no transition as yet. And if you look at historical data, every new energy supply simply adds to what we already had. We are using more traditional biomass, that's animal dung and wood and so today than we were in 1800. So we've got that traditional biomass, coal on top of that, petroleum, natural gas, nuclear, hydro, and so on. All of these things have simply added one to the other.
Because our use of energy has also increased.
That's right. And in fact, if you plot the use of energy against the population or against the GDP of the world, they're all the same curve, which underscores the importance of energy in enabling the growth of the human economy and the growth in human numbers. So if you pull that energy out, the whole system collapses. If you don't pull the energy out, suppose by magic it turns out that the green energy advocates are right, and we get a complete replacement of fossil fuels, then we carry on the current track of simply using up everything faster than it can produce, so on and so forth, and the system goes down anyway. So I don't care what magic solutions you propose. I don't think there are solutions.
What are your views on nuclear energy or nuclear reactors as a source of or a capacity by which we could replace fossil fuels?
I think it would be a disaster if it came about. Nuclear energy, for overall, look, I'm not a nuclear expert. Nobody has solved the nuclear waste problem. I underscore that. Nobody has solved the nuclear waste problem. Most nuclear reactors in this country and in the U.S. are sitting on the waste that they've generated for the last several decades. We don't know what to do with it in a safe manner. Some forms of nuclear energy may be less wasteful. Fusion energy, ever since I'm in universities, like 50 or 60 years, it's right around the corner, okay? and it's still right around the corner. So I don't have any. And besides which, and I must emphasize two points, it's electricity. 80% of our energy is not electricity. Secondly, if it were able to replace all of those other forms of fossil fuels, turn it into electrical use, it would be catastrophic for the universe anyway, or for at least the planet.
It's interesting because we come across very otherwise intelligent people that just don't see, like, they just don't seem to understand these things.
I'm dead wrong.
I don't think so. They think nuclear or some other magical technological solution will just solve things without thinking any of this through. Like you said, only, 20% of our energy is electricity, right? So nuclear is not going to solve all these other things. All the infrastructure you need to get nuclear to even get to the 20% of all of our energy needs in terms of electricity, that's another undertaking in and of itself.
Of course,
and
it
so
is.
On. So it's why do you think people are just so obviously people that haven't studied these things in depth, they just don't know some of these facts. But in general, why do you think they're so married to a magical technological savior, I guess? Like, what is it about us that is so drawn to just discounting all these? Because it seems like humans, should be loss averse. I mean, in behavioral economics, it's well established that humans are pretty loss averse. There's evolutionary reasoning that makes a lot of sense why we would, be on the side of being more cautious, and yet we have this completely blind optimism.
look, there's several layers to this, and we'll start with the first layer, that human beings are basically simple animals. And we have a natural instinctive...
What did you call me?
Okay, yeah, that's another thing. A lot of people are offended at the notion that they're animals. See, that's this idea, okay, look, we are animals. I'm going to make that assessment, and we are naturally optimistic. You have to be in order to survive in an evolutionary context. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that human beings are unique in that we don't live in reality. We make up stories.
That is true.
Sociologists call it the social construction of reality. So every culture has its set of myths, its accepted beliefs, values, and assumptions about the way things are. Now, these things may or may not have anything to do with reality, but that's how people live. They live as if their social constructs are truth. Sometimes it doesn't matter whether those truths match reality or not. So if you go back several hundred years and said in Europe, for example, hey, the earth is flat, nobody's going to dispute that. Well, of course the earth is flat. So that's a social construct. Everybody agrees that it's true. It's dead wrong, but it doesn't matter because you could live your life as if the earth was flat and never suffer any ill consequences. That is an example of what I call the first approximation of reality, which was good enough to get by. It wouldn't be good enough today because you can't fly airplanes or navigate the planet on an Earth is flat model. But it was good enough back then. Okay, so many of our constructs are not benign. They're dangerous. We talked about neoliberal economics. Neoliberal economics starts from the fundamental platform of Western civilization, which is one of human exceptionalism. Again, it's a social construct with deep religious roots, but embellished by the scientific revolution and through the Renaissance and scientific revolutions into thinking that humans are special in some way. We are so clever that we're not like the other animals. We have a soul, and therefore we're not like the other animals. And if we're not like the other species, then we're not part of nature. And if we're not part of nature, we don't have to pay any attention to the natural laws of physics and chemistry and all the rest of it.
I mean, it is easy to deceive yourself with it if you look around, by nature of technological progress. You don't see baboons hosting a podcast. I mean, you can make the argument this is as close as it's going to get. But like, I mean, it is a myth of so. Like, yes, it's a myth. It's a social construct. But we do have tangible evidence that we are surrounded by reminders that we are not, in fact, the same as our other mammalian counterparts.
No, we're not the same as other mammalian counterparts, but we're not that different either. The fact is that you don't see baboons destroying their habitats. You don't see species wrecking the planet on which they live. So we've blinded ourselves. So let's take a very simple example. The single most important biophysical law governing all of our behavior, something called the second law of thermodynamics. The second law says that any real process increases the entropy, the disorder of its environment. Any real process. Now, economics is nothing if it's not about a whole bunch of processes. And yet economics completely ignores the second law of thermodynamics. So what the second law says is that you can't do anything without creating a degree of disorder. Okay. So what human beings are doing is millions of processes that are increasing the disorder, the entropy of the planet, the dissipation of energy of fossil fuels into the atmosphere and the ocean is disordering the planet. The human displacement of non-human species is disordering the planet. The human movement of billions of tons of materials around the planet is disordering the planet. All of the symptoms we talked about earlier, of pollution and overconsumption, are examples of human beings taking valuable resources and converting them through processes involving energy into much, much smaller body of entities that we find useful products with utility, but at the cost of a vast increase in the entropic degradation of the planet. And that's what's going on. Nature works in a way in the opposite direction, because photosynthesis takes energy from off the planet, uses it to take very simple compounds, water, carbon dioxide, trace elements, to build this huge thing we call the ecosphere. But it uses an extraplanetary source of energy, which it dissipates, increasing the entropy of the universe while increasing the neg entropy, the complexity of planet Earth. So the ecosphere evolved, increasing the entropy of the universe, but by expanding itself. The human endeavor operates from within the ecosphere. It consumes the ecosphere to expand itself, but in the process destroys the ecosphere. So where you can think of the ecosphere, the planet Earth being a parasite on the sun, but human beings are a parasite on the ecosphere, which have sustained. I once wrote, this got me into a lot of trouble. I said that humans have become the maggot to Earth's apple. We're literally consuming the Earth from within. We are literally consuming and converting the rest of Earth into human bodies who are human artifacts, but at a huge expense.
I want to be clear, because sometimes people, especially people that lean, I think, toward the right politically, that will interpret things like this, like, oh my God, this person hates humanity and wants, you know, everyone to die. Like, this is just an observation. Like, these are, you know, you're spitting facts right now. Yeah, so I want to be clear, you know, we're not. Yes.
No.
Factual observations.
They are factual observations. No, I'm not anti-human. I just think we don't sufficiently understand ourselves. If we put all of this together, put all of our knowledge together, it's fairly simple to work out a way of being on the planet, which wouldn't destroy the planet, in which we would live compatibly with the biophysical processes upon which we depend and which really govern our relationships with everything else. We can do that. We just don't. And we don't because we're not operating from that mindset. Again, let's go back to the social construction of reality. If you create in your mind the notion that human is Superman, that we don't have to pay any attention to this other stuff, look, one of the rote underpinnings of neoliberal economics is the following. Human ingenuity is the greatest resource. Human ingenuity is the greatest resource. And they use things, and nobody, coal is a resource until we learn how to use it. Right. So it comes from the mind, not from nature. Nature just makes rocks called coal. But humans' ingenuity have turned it into this marvelous way of doing stuff. So there's a great deal of truth. Look, there's always truth in every story, if you will. But some stories map better. You see, we're looking at a map here. And let's say we all have different maps, but they all have the same place names on them. But your map has them scattered all over the place at random. And Andre's map has them placed in very symmetrical patterns. And my map is a map of reality. In other words, my map shows where those dots actually are. And if I follow the roads on my map, I'm going to get from A to B without fault. If I follow your road, I'm going to fall off a cliff somewhere because your map doesn't have anything to do with the biophysical reality upon which it's based. And that's exactly the situation we're in. We can create stories. We call them social constructs. Here are some. Every religious paradigm or doctrine, every academic paradigm, every economic thesis, even every scientific theory is a social construct. It came from the mind. But some of them are good maps of the reality that they purport to represent. Others have nothing to do with the reality. And the question is, does it matter? Does it matter that your map is not a good fit? If it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. But if it does matter, you've got a big problem.
It matters.
But,
How do you then propose that we write better stories or sell, you know, the actual accurate stories? How do we promote that? How do we change the narrative?
And I will kind of also maybe add an additional lens to that question, maybe to guide the conversation as we wrap up the episode towards solutions. And you have proposed a very like Wilsonian 11 points. Ranging from what Levon is asking about having people embrace the realities, the real stories, the realistic stories, all the way down to like, oh yeah, let's dismantle global capitalism. But building off of Levon's question about embracing reality, talk to us a little bit about some of the solutions you proposed, or at least to start mitigating the existential threats by overshoot. Of overshoot.
Okay, look, let me be clear here. I'm going to lay myself out. I don't think there are solutions.
On brand, okay.
Okay, so a problem is something amenable to solution.
Yes.
A predicament is a circumstance which has outcomes but no solution. So we are in a predicament. We used to have problems that were solvable. So, for example, ozone depletion was a solvable problem. But we've now advanced to the point where we're in a global predicament. There are just so many facets to the difficulties that we are in people come up with solutions like alternative green energy, which turns out to be as problematic as fossil fuel. By the way, we could spend a whole session just talking
about metals. Yeah, rare earth. Yeah.
Absolutely. The mining and catastrophic damage. Look, in 1992, the United Nations came up with the Framework Convention on Climate Change. Since then, that's what, 33 years ago, there's been 29 COP conferences, all oriented toward reducing carbon emissions and the use of fossil fuel. During that period, if you actually plot each of those events against the increase in carbon emissions, we've seen an exponential increase in emissions, and they're still rising. So the solution to the problem has been a complete and utter, I think, failure. Everything we've done has not reduced carbon emissions. Now, someone said, yeah, but they're less than they would be. Well, that's even debatable. Some argue that, well, all of the EVs and wind and solar towers are equivalent to 7% of current emissions. But that doesn't take into account the emissions generated in the manufacturing of automobiles and the mining and all the rest of it, for the rare earth metals and the extension of the grid system and all of that kind of stuff. The bottom line is that despite 29 meetings designated or oriented toward reducing emissions, they've gone steadily upward through the entire period. That's the nature of our solutions. We misdefine the problem. One of my philosopher friends once wrote a paper with a title like that. No amount of ethical reasoning or legal axiology will solve a problem that is misunderstood. Human beings simply misunderstand the problem because it's not a problem, it's a predicament. It's this multi-headed hydra. And if you chop one head off, then three more grow its place. And that's the way we've known about it. Just take overshoot. The simple solution to overshoot. Reduce less, or consume less. That's it. Reduce your consumption by 80% in North America. Now you're in the ballpark of what might be sustainable. Nobody's going to do that because we operate under this mindset that we can overcome the problem. Human ingenuity is the greatest resource. So if you believe that the economy and the ecosphere are separate systems, and that human ingenuity is the greatest resource and can substitute for anything provided by nature, then you have a mindset that enables perpetual infinite growth abetted by ever-growing advancing technology. That's where we are coming from. And it cannot solve any of the problems that we are creating as a result of overshoot, which is the fundamental problem. By the way, overshoot is the physical manifestation of something else. And that is the excess industrialization of the planet under the rubric of, well, what are your capitalist ideology and handmaiden neoliberal economics. All of those are social constructs that are based on completely false understanding of the nature of the reality of relationship between human beings and the rest of the ecosphere. So, again, let me repeat. As long as we keep striving for solutions from within the same set of beliefs, values, assumptions, and behaviors that created the problem, cannot solve the problem. Okay? I mean, Einstein said it, you cannot solve any problem at the same level of thinking that created it. But that's all we are doing. I don't care where I look these days. When I see people proposing solutions to the problem, they've misdefined the problem. They're looking at a symptom. And what they're doing isn't necessarily going to solve the problem. And it's certainly not going to resolve the larger issue of overshoot and the excess demand. I mean, the human system is simply vastly larger at its current level of consumption and pollution than the Earth can manage. It's as simple as that. the solution? Make it smaller. Degrowth is a great idea, but even the degrowth people won't look at the population issue because it's too politically charged. Well, that, again, that's a mental construct that departs from the nature of reality. No species in nature grows indefinitely, and when they do, they get slammed back if they attempt to do so. Humans will be slammed back.
You know, the population is very interesting because whether you try to, you know, artificially reduce it or, you know, just through fertility rates dropping, it gets reduced on its own. If it plummets too quickly, or maybe even if at all, but let's say, especially if it plummets too quickly, I think you have possibly, very possibly, economic chaos. In which case, how are, you know, you're even less likely to coordinate on these very important topics, right? And so it could paradoxically make things even worse if you have a smaller population, if the impact economically destabilizes society to the point where we are not in a comfortable enough state to try to develop, you know, not just technological solutions to things, but also better systems to like, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about how do you develop better international coordination systems? Because, you know, obviously global problem, you need global solutions. And one of the main issues is, you know, the UN is not very effective. How could you, you know, what kind of system could you put into place with the proper incentives and everything that could maybe try to sway things? I mean, we're nowhere near that culturally or politically, but it's just an idea. Like, how would you even go about that, you know?
I don't know. I don't pretend to know, but we've been talking about global systems of cooperation for the last half hour. The UN is an example. The the conference on climate is another example. We've got a biodiversity treaty that isn't working, a forestry treaty that isn't working. So all of these so-called international agreements and treaties are built on the same foundation, but don't take into account the fact that countries don't trust each other. People don't trust each other. Human beings, again, I'm going to go way back. If you lived in a small tribal group, it didn't matter. If somebody got out of line, they were fixed very quickly. Today, we've got billions of people with hundreds of different languages in dozens of different cultural settings, hundreds of countries, 150 or so countries, so that we just have no control over all of this. If you mistrust somebody, they're going to mistrust you. Look at the mess we're in over.
But hold on. So if things get bad enough, and yes, I agree that people don't trust each other, generally speaking. But if things get bad enough and the incentives start to change, where we're like, shit, okay, we need each other. And mm-hmm. I may not fully trust you, but I sort of need you and we need to kind of work together. Do you think that can set the basis for an implementation of a system that in theory could allow us to realign the incentives in a way that now we're actually we're accounting for nature as opposed to, you know, we have an economic system which totally disregards the impact on nature.
Yeah. An external threat does draw people together. That's how the Allies, you know, got together and completely rejigged their economies to fight the Second World War, for example.
I mean, you had the communists making close alliances with Winston Churchill, which is...
Yeah, absolutely.
Good luck with that outside of the context of war.
So that can happen. Here's my problem. If the threat is great enough to drive that kind of unity among the incredibly disparate nature of human beings right now on this planet, it will be too late. Even if they manage to pull themselves together to confront this problem, there will be vast suffering. I just think we're in a predicament that has no ready solutions. It's hard for people to understand this or to agree with it. You guys are fighting me on this. I can understand that. I wouldn't like us to go down in a mess either. But I just find it very difficult. And again, this is just me talking. You can think there's more.
And I think the reason we're challenging you on it is because we still have, I think, this is something that in many ways our generation is inheriting. Mm-hmm. And for us to look at the path laid out before us to come to the conclusion as of, oh my gosh, yeah, it's all fucked. Excuse the language. That's for the algorithm. It's a bleak reality to embrace as we are just stepping into a paradigm of like generational leadership. If the torch is being passed to us and we're embracing the torch, we can't come into it with an absolute nihilistic view on things. Not saying that you're a nihilist. It's of course you're going to be challenged on this by people that are younger.
Okay, so if I were really in charge right now, I would be saying to younger people to somehow come together with like-minded individuals, if you can find enough of you, to acquire some fairly productive land somewhere. Okay. Start raising draft horses and oxen, because if we fail to maintain our energy supplies, you're going to need some workhorses. Most people are unaware that in North America, you have the equivalent of 100 to 150 other people working for you 24/7 to maintain your current level of consumption and so on. So that's a huge amount of labor that will have to be replaced if, in fact, the energy supplies run dry. One barrel of oil is equivalent to 5 to 10 years of human labor. People, since we've simply had been able to take this for granted for the last 7 or 8 generations, nobody thinks about the consequences of losing all of that. And it means this will drive us back to community, which is a point in favor of your argument, right? In the old days, I grew up on a farm in southern Ontario 70 years ago. I've been in a couple of barn building exercises because communities came together in the face of common threats. Everybody knew, if I help this guy this time, he'll help me next time. I went back a few years ago, talked to my cousin. I said, look, remember those old days when da-da-da-da? What would happen today? He said everybody would say, screw him, he didn't have insurance. So, I'm serious. You see, we've created these cultural and social prosthetics that have divided people, that made us all into individuals, and you're on your own. We've lost that sense of community and social cohesion that existed at that level. No one will romanticize this. There's all the bullshit going on down there as well. But the point of the matter is we've kind of lost that thread in our evolutionary.
Yeah, many and times on the show, we revert back to like, the solution is to join the Mennonites.
Well, possibly so.
No. I mean, I think individually, yes, you'd be better off maybe getting more familiar with farming and kind of doing things on your own. And yes, that can, again, for you or your small community, that could be beneficial. But I want to ask you, like, what can we do now to soften the blow collectively? I'm talking about at a national or global level to smooth things out, because I don't think, you know, detaching from power games and the media and everything is going to make things we already are kind of screwed. But if all the people that care about this, you know, went and became, you know, like Amish folk, then, you know, then you got even more psychopaths. You got even more deranged individuals leading us with so much more leverage, right, in what they do. And I think like that, just seems like, it seems like, you know, we'd have to make some sort of, the people that care about this would have to make some sort of sacrifice if they want to make a difference.
Yeah, but right? you're making my case. Look at the last election in the United States. No person got elected to the Senate or Congress without several tens of millions of dollars being donated by vested interests in the maintenance of the status quo. And that's been going on for decades. So the governance system today is not a democracy. That's a shell game. What it is, it's an autocracy of people with lots of money basically buying the political system. They buy congresspeople, they buy senators in the US case, and they get their money's worth because those people are doing the bidding of the moneyed classes right now. And that's something you've got to simply come up against. By the way, 50% of your country is in support of these buggers. They elected them to get in there. do these.
I mean, the other buggers must have really dropped the ball in order to.
That's right. Energy. And the folks on the other side, on your side, as it were, sitting there with their thumbs up their butts, doing absolutely nothing about what's going on in Congress. So that's how corrupt the system is at the present time. And it gets worse. There's something called regulatory capture, in which we see this exchange of personnel between major regulatory agencies and those corporate entities that are supposed to be
regulating. Yeah.
That's that. And so you wind up with the regulators basically running the corporate entities and the corporate entity executives running the regulatory agencies. And you have a situation in which the agencies now operate for the values and so on of the corporate sector rather than the public interest. And that's been going along for ages, a lot longer than the current mess going on in Washington, among other places. So, look, what can ordinary people do? Against that, I can't see very much happening unless you do split off and become independent of this mess, because that mess is being controlled by people who have no interest whatsoever in anything we are talking about.
But that would only work if everyone was doing that. But people aren't, wouldn't it? I mean,
I think, to be honest, again, the system is going to go down. We're already on the downside. It's well known, for example, that the rise and fall of societies is completely coordinated with the rise and fall of energy use per capita. And we peaked at least a decade ago. We're on the downslope already. Okay. Now, the question is, who's going to survive? Who's best positioned to survive this? And I think will be people who have the most skills adapted to the kind of life that is going to be in the absence of fossil fuels when the rest of the system collapses. If the world were to go down today, if the global economy went down today, it wouldn't be people in New York that survive. It'll be peasants in various South American and Asian peasant societies who can grapple with any degree of depravity. They're basically
modern hunter-gatherers. Yeah.
Right.
Going to the Sentinel Islands.
There's still a billion folks out there in those circumstances. So people who are living subsistence lifestyles, who know how to deal with the exigencies of low energy and so on and so forth, are far more likely to survive a collapse of the global system than are people who are so coddled by modernity in Chicago and New York and Vancouver and so on.
I feel attacked.
They don't have a chance.
No, point taken.
One of your articles, though, you know, it talks about the concept of a social tipping point, which is, you know, if you've got 25% of a society accepting a certain belief, then that can really just kind of take over after that point. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like my hopium, you know, is, you know, if through just activity in media, if you can persuade enough people, if you can change the narrative enough so that maybe 25% of the people start to believe this, maybe that can have cascading effects. And, you know, I think the U.S., given that it's still, despite, you know, our best efforts, still a superpower in the world, right? And it's still maybe the superpower, right? And if you can change culture and politics in the U.S., I think that can have genuine downstream effects that can, it's not going to solve our issues, but it can soften the blow. And I think that's what my hope is can we kind of shift American culture and politics, because it has a disproportionate impact. Do you see that as just delusional, or do you think if that could be done, it should be done? I mean, what are your take? What's your take on that?
Well, I think you're perfectly justified. You used the word hopium.
Okay. Yeah.
So this, again, is the human optimism coming to the surface. And absolutely, that's human nature. I'm all for it. And look, some of us up here, north of the border, are looking down there and saying, I hope there's a counter-revolution. When are the Democrats and ordinary people who are getting shafted by what's happening in Washington, going to rise up en masse. That's the only thing that's ever made a real difference in the past.
Same time it's going to happen in Ottawa, I guarantee.
By the way, of course, I think our current prime minister has some major problems. But that's the point I'm getting at here is that if you look at what has induced major social change in the past, it's massive discontent. People rising up in the street in the tens of millions and saying, enough is a bloody well enough. We're not going to take it anymore, to use the popular expression. I don't see that yet happening. You know, there was a bit of it with the celebration during the big Trump military parade, the counter thing, what happened on Saturday.
The No Kings rallies.
No Kings rally. Well, that was good, but it should have been 10 times bigger.
A lot of people also still have to work Saturdays, too. So yeah, I think it's...
Well, yeah. But you see, we're all tied into the system.
Yes.
The system prevails. Which
you can make the case has been designed to prevent these things from happening, right? I mean, what are the chances you're going to go out onto the streets if your job is attached to your health insurance and
exactly.
Health insurance is an existential thing?
So you guys keep making my point that we created this enormous behemoth that we are committed to in almost every functional way you can imagine. And any attempt to overthrow it, literally, I mean, I fear the system coming down. What happens when you can't go to the grocery store and get that quart of milk or your dozen eggs? And that's what's in front of us if this system goes down. And yet, if the system doesn't go down, it's going to go down.
I think far more likely, my cynical conclusion that I draw from reading things you've written and from speaking to you and just from knowing how our kind of present bubble in the West works is that inevitably the cynical calculus is going to have to emerge where you start counting the amount of people in the world and how much the world can sustain them, as we've been talking about. And I think far more likely than any sort of the systemic changes that you've called for when you talk about solutions, the calculus is going to be run that, yeah, we're okay with, you know, those X amount of people from that particular group vanishing off the face of the earth. And I think that's when I get very... In a way,
India and Pakistan have nukes, by the way, just to be, it's not as simple as we're okay.
Far more likely to embrace some sort of genocidal position than actually try to reform itself. And that causes me a level of anxiety, I think.
Well, I have a very high level of anxiety about the future of civilization. I mean, again, how far do you go before there's a sufficient response to make a constructive difference? And my concern now is that we're so far down the pipe that the kinds of major changes, the cultural or social tipping points, are likely to be as likely to be catastrophic as they are. Including, I mean, Levon mentioned the Pakistani and Indian nukes. What happens when somebody just fuck it and pushes the button just because they want it all to be over? And everybody else jumps into the fray. That's the kind of stupid event that is at least...
We saw a demonstration of that last weekend.
Okay. What's the U.S. going to do when China finally decides, all right, the U.S. is so weak, we're just going to take Taiwan? What do you do now? And why do they want Taiwan anyways? It's all, the world's being run. This is another thing we could talk about all day. Psychopathy is
That comes up in every episode on this podcast. Okay. I know you haven't listened to every single episode, just like maybe 90%, but...
It's a real thing, psychopathy. Yeah. Okay? It's a brain problem where people have no compassion, no feeling about others, and there's a much higher level of psychopathy among leaders in Wall Street, in the corporate sector, and in government than anywhere else. So in our very complex societies, we get people who, by the way, were probably very valuable back in the day when a few completely deranged individuals may have been what was necessary to keep the tribe alive. But today it becomes disadvantageous. I should have emphasized that way back at the beginning. See, with our cultural and social evolution, a large number of qualities of human behavior, which were adaptive 10,000 years ago, have become maladaptive in the modern world. And the tendency of psychopaths to rise to position of power is, I think, a pretty good example of that.
Right. We had more natural checks back in the day. When you have smaller tribes, it's more transparent, those things. And you usually don't elect the most psychopathic person. You tend to elect people that are a little more fair and caring. But yeah, in modern society, there are those natural checks don't exist.
We admire the people with the balls to get into those heavy duty positions, right? And again, we, to some extent, that's a social construct, isn't it? Are you guys familiar with the Lewis Powell memorandum? Look it up. Lewis Powell, just as it sounds, P-O-W-E-L-L. So this goes back to, I guess, Nixon in the 1970s, 1971. It's been some time since I've looked at this, but Powell was a corporate lawyer, advisor to the Nixon regime. And it was in that era when the women's liberation movement, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, all of these things were starting to take hold and gain real power in the United States and in Canada. And Powell saw this as a huge risk, a danger to the corporate way of life.
Free enterprise.
That's right. So he wrote this memorandum to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, raising this flag and saying, look, we've got a real problem on our hands. We have to purposefully set out to change the political dialogue here, the discourse. And we've got to get rid of such concepts as the common good, the public interest, and so on and so forth, and replace it with individualism, the corporate values, the value of individuals getting out there and fighting for themselves, and so on and so forth. And the way we do this is to fund chairs in economics, to set up political science departments, to establish think tanks across the United States to promote corporate values. And that's exactly what happened. I'm not saying it's the only thing that happened, but it was a major catalytic, talk about social tipping point. So if you think back to the Reagan, Thatcher, in Canada, Brian Mulroney, they all jumped on this bandwagon. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is Margaret Thatcher's most famous saying was, there's no such thing as society. It was a throwaway line at a garden party, but it's what she's remembered for mostly. Society is just a bunch of individuals serving their own self-interest. So that was the beginning of the social construction of the neoliberal flood, which has taken over the world in the past 50 or 60 years, mm-hmm. triggered in part by the Lewis Powell memorandum. Read that memorandum and the history and all of the dialogue that's gone on around it. See what a powerful thing it is. So many of the right-wing think tanks, which are creating national policy in the United States today, are funded by corporate interests who are responding to the simplicity of the Powell memorandum. So that's how you make social change. But you need billions of dollars in 50 years to do it. So they were able to turn around. When I was a youngster, I'm an old bugger, eh? We used to run elections in Canada based almost entirely on the public interest. What is the common good? Those words never appear anymore. They've been abolished from political language, virtually. There's still one party that talks a little bit about them. The main point is we've gone over to the dark side, as it were, and that's the way politics are in the world today. Now, yes, you're right. It could be changed around if only we did this and only we did that, and if all the media got together and said this, that, but
not all the media. Whoa, not all the media. I mean, I think well, it would help, yes. But I think what the recent election, for example, showed, I think the media landscape is changing. There's a lot of independent journalism.
Well, hence
journalism.
The panic of the Democratic Party to find liberal Joe Rogan, throwing.
But yeah, but off. You see the disproportionate power and influence of influencers like Joe Rogan. I mean, his decision to endorse Trump may have swung the election. That's entirely possible. I mean, that's the level of influence that you can have with something like a podcast, right? Of course, it's the most popular podcast in the world, but the point is, I don't think you need to hit every single component of the system to make these changes. I think there are levers that you can pull that might be able to just swing things enough, again, to hopefully soften the blow just a little bit.
I think, and Dr. Reese, you do a really great service by bringing up some of like the political machinations of the conservative movement in the United States, because they've been very effective at deploying their visions. And the irony being is that a lot of the conservative scholars of the 70s look to Bolshevism as a way to inspire their own effective organizing on the ground. So I think we just got to keep that rule book going, right? We need to study how things like the Lewis Powell Memorandum worked. And I think we need to find a way to replicate the successes of that in service of countering some of these existential threats that we talked about today.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with that. But we see, we're always talking about this is what we should do.
Yes.
What we don't focus on enough is how do you go about doing that and with what resources?
Yeah.
So I don't think we disagree. It would be lovely to soften the blow. When I talked earlier about people getting together at a community level, and that's really what I meant, soften the blow for them at least. But in terms of how do you get a liberal, you mentioned Joe Rogan, a tremendously powerful influencer. The media landscape is so fractured today that it's increasingly difficult, it seems to me, to bring together people of like mind. Guys like you, there's just dozens of folks doing podcasts like this. We're all operating in isolated little, you know, we're all in our little isolated silos and not pulling in the same direction necessarily. In fact, we're competing with each other to some extent. So it's a difficult situation. We've created of the planet a Tower of Babel. You know, there used to be, when we had major national media, I'm not saying they were good things. I'm not saying the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever are necessarily good things, but at least you had a reference point. Everybody was gathered around the water cooler and talked about the same issues. Today, it doesn't happen. We don't have, it seems to me, national gathering points. And the mainstream is doing everything they can to dismantle the ones that we do have. I mean, Trump is intent on dismantling NPR and so on. In Canada, we have a mini Trump in the form of a conservative leader who wants to banish the CBC, which is practically the only thing holding the country together in any ideological sense. So, yeah, they know what they're doing. The rest of us are floundering looking for solutions to what I think is a major predicament that doesn't have any easy solutions. Now, I think we can manage bits of it on the way down, but it is going to go down. We can't, you know, every culture, every society has gone through a cycle of rise to some pinnacle of success, and then it corrupts itself and begins a decline. Sometimes the decline takes a century, other times it's really rapid.
Don't talk about Canada. Don't talk about Canada like that.
Yeah, we don't.
The U.S. will be.
Well, I think the U.S. is, you know, if the U.S. is the kind of beacon, the U.S. has been the world's beacon for 200 years.
Beacon of overshoot.
Very, very generous.
Yeah. No, but literally, look at here. Well, here's something else that amazes many Canadians. The U.S. Constitution has been held up as one of the most brilliant exercises in human institutional ingenuity ever conceived. It's just, you know, and yet every day you now have a president who flagrantly violates important provisions of the U.S. Constitution, and most Americans don't give a damn.
I think largely because Congress doesn't give a damn.
Well, but the American
people, I think the people don't either, to be honest. A lot of people.
But you underscore my point again, that even our great beacons have been undermined and undercut. And the more he gets away with, the more it becomes normalized. It becomes normal to disregard the Constitution as just a piece of paper that had no real significance anyway, and let's just get on with running the country the way Trump once. So again, my hope is that there is sufficient discontent that enough people begin to realize what a travesty this is that Trump has overthrown, either by Congress finally waking up to doing its constitutional duty, by the courts finally waking up to do their constitutional duty. There's some resistance by the lower courts, but the Supreme Court seems to be too much pro-Trump. But if people wait, again, these are all big if statements. If this happens, then that will happen. Well, if this happens, then you've got some opportunity to pull through this with some degree of dignity. But if it doesn't happen, then, and again, Trump is following the playbook of Hitler and Viktor Orban and all of the various commentators.
There's a couple of people between Hitler and Viktor Orban that probably deserve to be mentioned.
The point I'm getting at is...
Right, yeah, understood.
It's this oligarchical, this quasi-fascist...
We're trying not to totally alienate our one Hungarian listener or whatnot. You know, it's understood. No, point taken. And well received.
Yeah. It's a mess. We are in a predicament. Again, to use that concept, predicaments have outcomes, but not necessarily solutions. Predicaments have outcomes that may or may not be better than the situation in which you start. And we are in a predicament right now globally, and little predicaments all over the place. The United States is in a predicament. I think you've got a huge predicament in getting back control for the people of the governance system of the United States so that reflects some kind of sensibilities. Now, some would say, well, it does. They were elected by the people. Well, we'll see how that goes.
Well, step one, step one to address all of this was to invite you on our podcast. So
we have started the daisy chain.
Yeah, we are well on our way.
Let's pat ourselves on the back for this one.
Yeah. Much thanks to you for coming on. It was really just a fantastic conversation.
Yes.
You're just excellent. All the work that you've done, you're a great speaker. So we really appreciate it. If people want to find more of your work, where can they go?
Just look online for my name. There's lots of papers. And I never post anything personally. Oh, I just started doing a little bit of stuff the last week or so on Substack, I guess. But other than that, other people put things up like you guys are doing right now.
On your behalf.
Yeah. By the way, I'm, believe it or not, a humble person. Everything I have said to you may be complete BS. It's just how I have come to understand the world. I have no solutions. I thrive on hope as you do, that things will turn out okay. But again, I'm a realist. You know, people talk about optimism and pessimism, and I'm often thrown in the pessimist bag. And I say, listen, optimism and pessimism are states of mind. They have nothing to do with reality, necessarily. Okay? I want to be a realist. I'm a scientist. I look at the data. I look at the trends. Where are things going? What does it look like? Where would this go if it kept going in that direction? What if it changed in that direction? And how could you do that? Those are the kinds of questions I'm asking. Is this just symptomatic, or is it the whole problem? Am I looking here at a simple part of this issue, or is this only a something of a much more complex issue? Going back to our original point, people think in simple terms. The reality is vastly more complex than we can imagine. Not that we do imagine, it's more complex than we can imagine. And that's the real hook here. We cannot imagine how it's going to turn out.
But we will do our best.
We will keep trying to do so.
Do not go gentle into the dark night.
That's right. So keep kicking and fighting. That's all I do. And let's hope things turn out.
Yeah, we've been inspired by you and the hope.
Thank you for that. Inspiration, but anyway. Listen, I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Doctor.
Of course.
Very good questions.
Thank you so much.
You guys are really on top of it, and I like to see that in interviews. So thank you so much.
No, thank you so much. And, we'd love to have you back on at some point. So hopefully things...
if we make it through the next year, hey.
We'll do an annual check-in with you. How fucked are we?
All right.
2026.
I've got a new scale. It's called the fucked upery scale. And going up or down.
Exactly. It would be like the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
Okay, Chaps. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Doctors.